Blog Talk Radio.
Dad, I got a fish!
Father's Day, a day to say thanks to the most important guy in the world. This year, get him what he really wants at Cabela's Father's Day sale. Take 40% off Cabela's Tourney Trail Rods, $200 off a Traeger Liltex Pro Bronze Grill, and $30 off Merrill Reflex Hikers and Mocs. Plus, spend $150 and get $25 in Cabela's Bucks. Good on your next purchase. Minimum purchase required. See store for details. Come to Cabela's Father's Day sale. In-store and online at Cabela's.com.
Log Talk Radio.
This thing right here,
yeah.
It's for my people in the streets.
Yes, today. You know, as we start this show, this one mic.
We hail. There is a pause throughout the stadium as the man sounds like he just coughed up a lung. They're looking around the Jumbotron shows and fans, the cheerleaders, and as it goes down each cheerleader's face, each one breaks up into laughter, which at this particular time destroys half the stadium. The other half is still trying to figure out what the hell just happened. Does this guy need CPR or something? And then at that particular time, I lost it. Devon Druck.
Yes. Today,
Love Talk Radio.
This show, this one mic.
Phoenix is another place. They got a great training staff. I mean, they were able to breathe life back into Shaq. And if you can do that, you know, people talk a lot about their training staff.
Yes, today, you know, as we start this show, this one mic.
You're listening to One Mic with D. Wills, and we are spending a little bit of time on this day where we will be, you know, much of the world will have its eyes and attention focused on Louisville, Kentucky, where Muhammad Ali's final resting place. And, you know, one of the things I mentioned, and, you know, I've had a couple opportunities to kind of talk about this, did a great show with Hank, and many of y'all know Hank from Inside the Park, and, you know, this is a person that has a very broad perspective, and so definitely should check it out. If you have a chance to go to our Real Sports Guys podcast, you know, that's a great place to kind of catch up on a lot of our things on iTunes. But I think he had a great perspective on it. And then I've got a chance to kind of scan and hear what, you know, folks have been saying around the country. And what makes Ali so interesting is the complexity that he brings to the table, that when you think about the development and who he was across his lifetime, you know, I think a lot of times when people are, I heard a number of folks talking about kind of Ali and also his relationship with, you know, and his beginnings and his work in terms of the Nation of Islam and, you know, what that meant. And, you know, I think a lot of it is when you think about, the identity development of a lot of black men at that time who were trying to find a voice and find a way to counter what they were experiencing in a way that brought back who they were. And there's a lot you can debate, and this is not going to be a debate about the Nation of Islam, but this idea of, you know, so people frame him as a puppet or a front person for this movement, kind of is a simple way of kind of talking about who he is. And so without understanding the complexities of a lot of black men at that time in terms of them trying to find a place where there was a voice for what they were feeling and experiencing in that time. And so this idea of a young person who would have, you know, been a, you know, someone in a college range age trying to figure out who they are, you know, people kind of frame them as though they were 45 years old at the time, making 45-year-old decisions rather than young people trying to figure that out. So, you know, you know, we'll get a little bit into that. You know, this is One Mic with D. Wilson. You know, we will, you know, have an opportunity to get in with that more with our guy, Doug Fisher here. You know, the thing I love about Doug is that, you know, this is a person who is, I always talk to my students about being passionate about what it is that you want to do. And whatever it is, like, throw yourself into that and try to be the best that you can be in it. And, you know, if anybody who's had a chance to follow him and to watch him knows that, like, he is a student of boxing. He is someone who is always honing, improving, and trying to bring you the best that he can bring. And so, and we consider him a friend of the program. We consider him someone who, when we need to get perspective, along with my man, Mr. Briggs, who comes in from boxing.com, have a couple people who I just tap into to say, look, I need perspective on this. And he's definitely someone that need. I reached out to him and he was like, let's talk about it. So we like to bring him to the stage. You know, our man and our friend of realsportsguys.com family, our man, Doug Fisher. How you doing, my man?
Hey, I'm doing fine. How you guys doing?
You know, I'm all right. You know, so, you know, usually we have a three-man booth. I'll have Marcus and I'll have Phil. And you know, this, I think this is the first time I've had you on our One Mic, which is kind of this format where we want to go deeper into an issue. A lot of times when we brought you on before, okay, we might be talking about something and we'll hit a couple other topics. But what's great about this format is that what I'm trying to do is, like, take one issue and then we're going to go in deeper as long as we can with it. And obviously, you know, with the passing of Muhammad Ali, this is something that, you know, I feel like I haven't been able to talk enough about because of just when you start to peel back the layers of his life and kind of lay it over what was happening in a larger society, as he was kind of, you know, from a, you know, the young, as a young man to his career in boxing to as he aged in life, you know, it's just, it's a unique kind of story. It's an American story in many ways. And so I guess I want to start with you and kind of just get your general perspective. You know, when you heard he passed, you know, kind of what did that, how did you feel at that moment? What was kind of your feeling at that moment when you knew he was no longer with us?
It's kind of like a death in the family, but like the passing of a grandparent or, you know, your favorite great uncle. You know, that they've lived full lives. They've been around a long time, and you sort of mentally or emotionally prepared for it for a number of years because they've been sick, maybe close to death a few times. So you kind of brace yourself for it, but still, when they do pass, there's this great feeling. That, you know, there's this feeling of loss. It does sort of, it still hits you. The passing has a lot of impact. And that's kind of the way it was for me. You know, I had just got done working a show here in Los Angeles, Golden Boy Promotions, which owns the Ring magazine and RingTV.com, which I'm an editor of. They do a monthly club show series at a historic venue in downtown L.A. And we had literally just finished a stream, maybe 15, 20 minutes before the news hit social media. And the producer of the show, who had like an Ali tribute package ready to go in case Ali passed during the show, had us come down to sort of like the basement area of the theater, and they just kind of made it sort of a makeshift studio and just basically pushed some stuff out of the way and rolled the cameras and got the whole streaming thing going. And my colleague Steve Kim and I just kind of talked about Ali for 20 to 25 minutes, but I just recall feeling kind of numb while talking, you know, and you know, it was a mixture of sadness, but also relief because, you know, I know like a lot of people have known for a number of years that Ali had been in failing health and he'd been hospitalized a number of times, and, you know, the combination of his age and Parkinson's syndrome and other various, you know, physical ailments, you know, really imprisoned him in his own body. And, you know, you don't want anybody who is beloved to you to suffer for too long, you know. So there's that relief, you know. And then it's kind of hard to really reflect on Ali, because, as you probably noted, you know, his life and his career spanned so many decades, and it encompassed so many incarnations. He changed, you know, and he evolved as an individual, as a human being, sort of on the public stage. And it's a lot to take in, and it's a lot to talk. It's a lot to process. It really is. It's not easy. And I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, remember there was a movie done on Ali starring Will Smith. I think it was produced more than 15 years ago. Maybe it was, you know, 16, 17 years ago, maybe late 90s, maybe 2000 or so. And it didn't, you know, it didn't do that well, and there were, you know, it was criticized or whatever. But it was, I mean, I looked at that movie as kind of like an impossible task, because just Ali was such a larger than life persona, and he did so much during his boxing career and outside of his boxing career that it's almost an impossible task to dramatize it for screen or for stage. And also, Ali has just been covered more than any modern professional athlete or any modern celebrity, really. I mean, his life has been looked at and dissected and analyzed and covered so much that just the footage that's out there just speaks for itself. And it's hard for anything to compare to that, because you couldn't make Ali up if he didn't already exist, if that makes any sense.
Yes. Let's start from the boxing side of it. You know, when you think about his place in boxing history and what he brought to the game of boxing, what are the things that come to mind for you?
Well, he was definitely a celebrity boxer. I mean, you've got a lot of great boxing champions of the past. The Hall of Fame is filled with worthy fighters, men who really, you know, who earned the moniker great. Ali, of course, called himself the greatest really before he'd proved it, but he went on to prove it. But you know, my point is, he was in the public eye. He was an Olympic gold medalist. He traveled to the Rome Games in 1960, and he won a gold medal in the light heavyweight division. And he turned heads there with his talent and his personality. And his talent and his personality continued to turn heads when he turned pro and when he worked his way up the ranks. And it wasn't all positive at first, because, you know, to the establishment, and boxing was kind of old fashioned at the time. His mouth was a little too big, and his style wasn't what people were used to seeing from heavyweights. We'd seen a little bit of it going way back to the 20s with Gene Tunney and sort of a stick and move style, but for the most part, most of your notable heavyweight champions were search and destroy type guys. They stalked forward. They generally had power. They were, if they were boxers, they were aggressive boxers, like Floyd Patterson. But you know, the ones that were really beloved by the public and by the sports media, guys like Joe Louis and Rocky Marciano, they were punchers, and you know, they were fairly stationary, and you know, their whole thing was they walk their man down and chop him down, or they take him out with one punch. And the guy who was the heavyweight champ at that time, who was viewed as every bit as devastating and dominant as Joe Louis, was Sonny Liston. And Liston was a very good boxer, a great boxer. He's in the Hall of Fame. But his thing was he whacked guys out of there. He hurt guys. And he was an intimidator. So, you know, Ali was calling him out not long after he turned pro. I mean, Ali was really sort of began this sort of, you know, public campaign to, you know, to rally public support, to sort of beat the drums for an eventual showdown between he and Sonny Liston, which was crazy because he was so young. He was still growing into the heavyweight division. Like I said, as an amateur, he finished his amateur career as a light heavyweight, which meant he weighed in at 178 pounds. And heavyweight is, you know, at that time was right around 200 pounds. And if you were a big heavyweight, you were over 200 pounds. You know, you were 215, 220, which was sort of Sonny Liston's range. So it was kind of crazy that he was calling him out and that he was doing so with such bravado. And I think if you were younger, you were amused by it. And if you were older, it rubbed you the wrong way. But whether you loved or hated Cassius Clay, most people thought that he was going to get beat up pretty good by Sonny Liston. So when he beat Sonny Liston, it made a huge splash, not only in the boxing world, but in the sports world. And he kept it coming. Like, literally, that fight, which took place in Miami in 1964, It just kind of changed the game in many ways, because the way Ali went about the weigh-in, his antics at the weigh-in, going crazy and you know, yelling and hollering and coming in with a huge entourage that had never been seen before. And it was so off the chain for the times that people really thought that he was suffering a nervous breakdown, or he was unraveling psychologically. And he was scared that he didn't want to fight him. And he even took his blood pressure, and you know, that's part of the whole weigh-in thing. You know, there's a doctor's examination. And at least one of the physicians said, hey, man, this man is unfit to fight. He's terrified. He's freaking out here. He was trying to get into Liston's head, and I think he did to an extent, although Liston kept his cool at the weigh-in. But the attention that weigh-in received, it helped sell the closed circuit. You know, tickets to that fight. And closed circuit is sort of the precursor to pay-per-view. It's where you would go to a theater and you would, you know, like go to see a movie, but you would watch a live fight. And that's how the people in the boxing industry made a lot of money. And this closed circuit did very, very well indeed. And I think a lot of promoters took note, and, you know, long after that, the weigh-in became more of a media event, sort of like the final press conference or the announcing press conference. It was it became a media event unto itself. But before Cassius Clay, Sonny Liston, for first fight, that wasn't the case. And then, of course, during the fight, he overcomes some adversity. He forces the feared Sonny Liston, an 8-1 favorite, to remain on his stool. He wins. And he's incredible. You know, his post-fight interview is unlike. I mean, there had never been a post-fight interview like that, where the winner is crowing about himself like that, just to the top of his lungs. And I think you alluded to this earlier. You know, we have to remember how young he was. He had just turned 22. So he was, you know, the second youngest man to have ever won the heavyweight crown up to that point. Floyd Patterson had been the youngest at age 21. But that interview was just, like, amazing. And, again, it was polarizing. It attracted a lot of people, and it also offended a lot of people, the traditionalists. And I don't think it was long after he had won what was still the biggest prize in sports at the time, the heavyweight championship, but he announces that he has joined the Nation of Islam. He is converted from Christianity to Islam, and he changes his name to Muhammad Ali, which was, I mean, for that time, that was just insane. I mean, it's really, you know, if you would have told him at that time that at his funeral, you know, wherever the funeral procession goes, people are chanting, people of all, you know, religious backgrounds, of all nationalities, of all ethnicities, from all cultures would chant a Muslim name, Ali, he wouldn't have believed it himself. you know, to be quite honest. So, I mean, for a lot of people, that was just like career suicide right there. Change your name from Cassius Clay to Muhammad Ali. I mean, people didn't want to say it. It was just like, my God,
Yes.
And it's hard to, it's kind of hard to comprehend now. But he kind of helped make that acceptable. He forced it, basically. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So it was actually, I think before he went with Muhammad Ali, I think he was Cassius X for a little bit. But then it was Muhammad Ali. By 65, it was definitely Muhammad Ali. His heavyweight title rank really started with a bang. And it was very unique. And it garnered a lot of attention. And part of that, I mean, part of the, you know, he went on sort of a world tour. He fought outside of the U.S. more than American heavyweight champions because there are a lot of places, a lot of states didn't want him fighting there. They were really freaked out by the whole Nation of Islam thing. So he fought in Toronto. He fought in London. He fought in Germany. And, you know, and this is I'm talking about the mid-60s here. So like 1966, he fought five times. I think at least three of those times, three or four, was outside of the U.S. But this also helped make him a global name. And, I mean, I think he was – the name Ali by the 70s had become a global brand really before global brand, you know, global and global brand were really terms. So very much ahead of his time, and his early reign was controversial. He was super dominant. He brought a style to boxing, like I said, to the heavyweight division that they hadn't seen. That sort of, you know, the fast footwork, the fast hands, stick and move thing, that's something that the boxing establishment in the sports world was used to seeing from the lighter weight classes. That's what they saw from, you know, a Willie Pep at featherweight, a Sugar Ray Robinson at welterweight. They weren't used to seeing that from the heavier fighters. So that was also something that was unique about his reign. And of course it came to an early end. You know, he was, you know, he didn't want, you know, he opposed the Vietnam War, refused induction into the army, was stripped of his title, was banned from the sport during his court case, which went all the way to the Supreme Court. And I think he gained a lot of people, not just African-Americans, but the youth of the time that was also morally opposed to Vietnam, the kids, the people who were his age, the people who were in colleges, they really identified with Ali because of his convictions, his beliefs, and just the guts that he had to stand behind them at the cost of his personal fortune, his career, which, had, you know, he had just entered his physical prime as an athlete, as a boxer, and maybe his personal freedom, because he could have gone to jail. And a lot of people identified with that because it was a time of political change and social unrest, and, you know, nationwide protest was something that was quite common at the time, particularly within the youth of America. So I think he began to become sort of iconic to the youth of America by the end of the 60s and during his exile. But then he had a part two to his boxing career when his license was reinstated and he came back. And the 1970s version of Muhammad Ali is the version that I'm familiar with because I'm a child of the 70s and I was born in 1970. And when I first sort of became aware of sports or the world of boxing, it was through Ali, and because he was the heavyweight champ. And I'm talking about the late 70s. I'm talking about 1977 and 78. I don't remember, obviously, you know, his three fight series with Joe Frazier.
Let me, because you're hitting in the space that I think both of us share. We're gonna take a break here because I want to in this next segment talk about the second half, and I think we both kind of share this space because, you know, I was basically 70s. That's where I grew up, you know, understanding Ali. And when we come back, I want you to get into that because I think that's something that both of us share. And this is great. This is actually what I knew we were going to do. We have an opportunity on One Mic, we're remembering Ali with Doug Fisher, editor of ringtv.com. When we come back, we're going to talk about the second half of Ali's career with Doug and share a perspective. This is great. This has been really good. Check us out again on realsportsguys.com. Click, go to iTunes, download the podcast. This is one you definitely want to keep listening to. We will talk to you again about this when we come back.
Razorbacks, and you're keeping it real with the Real Sports Guys. Whoopig.
If you like to lose your money, be a fool and bet on Sonny.
Clay comes out to meet Liston, and Liston starts to retreat. If Liston goes back in his father, he'll end up in the ringside seat. Clay swings with his left. Clay swings with his right. Look at young Cassius carry the fight. Liston keeps backing, but there's not enough room. It's a matter of time. And Clay lost the moon.
I don't have a mark on my face, and I upset Sonny Liston, and I just turned 22 years old. I must be the greatest. I told the world, I talk to God every day. If God's with me, can't nobody be against me, Sonny. I'm just out the world. I know the real God.
Cassius, wait a minute, Cassius.
I am the king of the world.
Hold it.
I'm pretty.
Hold it, you're not that pretty.
I'm a bad man.
Wait.
I shook up the world.
You're listening to One Mic. We are in this day where the world is focused on Louisville, Kentucky. There's been a two-day ceremony culminating with his funeral today. We're here with Doug Fisher, editor of ringtv.com. And Doug has done an excellent job kind of laying the foundation, kind of getting us in. But, you know, we're moving into the 70s, and in some ways this is where Doug and I probably share our experience with Ali, and where, you know, he really begins to hit us in a different way coming out of, in some ways, you know, missing much of his prime, only to come back and try to recenter himself in the world of boxing. So, Doug, I know you were talking a little bit about the 70s. What's the second half of his career look like? Before you get in, I was watching a clip of Leon Spinks, and you kind of forget how good the Spinks brothers were.
But I remember watching
that fight with Ali, and when he lost, I remember wanting to cry, you know, because it felt like, wow. But there was a lot that happened up until that moment. So you were kind of getting into the 70s stated. I'll let you take it from here.
Yeah, and by the way, you know, I can go on and on and on, particularly about Ali. But if you have any questions, feel free to interrupt. If you have any questions about Ali in the 60s or Ali during his exile, feel free to ask him. But, yeah, he came back from the exile heavier, obviously a little bit older, maybe not quite in his athletic peak, at his athletic peak anymore. He probably missed his athletic peak. You know, heavyweights generally mature slower than other weight classes. They're bigger. And usually they really hit their primes in their late 20s, and his late 20s was spent outside of boxing, unfortunately. So, you know, he came back a little bit older, a little bit heavier, did something that, you know, by today's standards is just crazy. He fights the number one contender, at least recognized by Ring Magazine, Jerry Querry, in his first comeback fight. Now, he's been gone more than 3 years. I mean, think about that. Most guys, particularly in the modern age, they're gone that long. I mean, listen, when Mike Tyson was in jail for about 3 years, when he came back, he fought Peter McNeely, who was literally a club fighter. And it says something about, you know, the modern age of boxing, the pay-per-view era, and Mike Tyson's fame, that was a huge pay-per-view event. And that might be one of Don King's masterpieces right there. You know, actually selling Mike Tyson versus Peter McNeely. But that wasn't – here's the thing. You know, my point about that is that wasn't criticized heavily by the sports media or the boxing press, because people understand, you know, when you're away from your sport for that long, I mean, forget ring rust. I mean, you know what I mean? It's your body's not the same. Yeah. You kind of have to work your way back into the sport, and it's customary to have what are known as tune-up fights, or in the boxing industry known as gimme fights. Means this is a gimme. We're going to give you a win to get, you know, knock off the ring rust, get your confidence back. You know, you start to rediscover your rhythm. You pick up your timing and your reflexes, which is so important to a boxer like Ali, because he wasn't a search-and-destroy fighter. He wasn't a flat-footed puncher like a Joe Louis or a Rocky Marciano. He didn't rely on power. He relied on hand and hand-eye coordination, foot-eye coordination. He relied on lateral movement, which is the control of distance. So he had to be on point. So it's a big deal that he was taking on somebody like Querry, who was very dangerous at that time and would remain a top 10 contender throughout the 70s and a dangerous one at that. And Ali faced him. It was a huge event. It took place in Atlanta. It was a huge event in African-American society at the time. If you were anybody in Black America at that time, you were at that fight. You wanted to witness the return of the king. And he delivered, and he scored a third-round stoppage, you know, cut poor Jerry up. And from there, he was scheduled in a 15-round title elimination bout against a real tough contender named Oscar Bonavena, who was tough as nails, had given Joe Frazier fits in two fights. Frazier, who knocked out everybody, couldn't knock this guy from Argentina out. And Bonavena actually took Ali, he was very strong and very awkward. He took Ali into the 15th round, but Ali stopped him, you know, knocked him down three times with one left hook. And thus the showdown with Joe Frazier was on. And in Ali's absence, Joe Frazier really emerged as the man in the heavyweight division. He had won heavyweight champion recognition from the New York State Commission by stopping Buster Mathis, who was supposed to go to the 1964 Olympics in Tokyo, but broke his hand and he couldn't. The alternate was Joe Frazier. Joe Frazier shocks everybody, surprises everybody by knocking out, you know, boxers on his way to a gold medal win in Tokyo. And he turned pro in 1965 in Philadelphia, which was his home. And he cut a path through the heavyweight division, knocked out Ali's stablemate, Jimmy Ellis, to gain at least one portion of the heavyweight title. But, I mean, honestly, by the time Ali was back into boxing, Joe Frazier was recognized by Ring Magazine and by most of the sports media and most of the public. Even members of the public that were Ali fans, they recognized Joe Frazier as the champion. But he couldn't be undisputed until he fought, because Ali did not lose his title in the ring. He was stripped of his title. That was politics. That wasn't another boxer. So you had a unique situation with the 1971 showdown between Ali and Joe Frazier, in which you had two undefeated heavyweights, both very dominant in their own right, and both with legitimate claims to the heavyweight crown. And it was billed the fight of the century, and it really was. I mean, the world stopped still for that fight, and it was at the time it was the biggest fight. It was the biggest money fight, and it was, you know, one of those fights where not just America but the world turned their attention to the prize ring. And that hadn't happened that often in the sport of boxing, but it was definitely true at Madison Square Garden in New York City in 1971. And it was an epic fight. And really, in my mind, even though Ali lost that fight, to me, that was one of his finest performances because we really learned that he was just as tough as he was skilled and talented in those 15 rounds. And really, Frazier got the worst of that beating. He was hospitalized for at least 10 days afterwards. And Ali was actually in the hospital maybe for a day or so. They had feared that his jaw was broken. But both fighters gave a lot of themselves. So, you know, Ali was no longer undefeated after that. And people began to realize, hey, he's not unbeatable now. And he lost to Ken Norton, and his jaw was broken in that first fight. And like a true champion, he came back immediately and beat Ken Norton in the rematch. Then had his rematch with Joe Frazier in 74 and won the rematch by decision, 12-round decision. And then he traveled to Africa, what was then known as Zaire. It was previously the Congo, and I think it's the Republic of the Congo, the Democratic Republic of the Congo. But it was in Africa, which was, a first for the heavyweight championship, and he was fighting George Foreman. Another Olympic gold medalist. Foreman had come out of the 1968 Olympics and in Mexico City, and he was the prototypical modern heavyweight. He was huge, and he was strong, and he could box, and he could certainly punch, and he was undefeated, I think, in 37 fights, and he had knocked out most of those fighters, you know, including Joe Frazier in just two rounds. Including Ken Norton, the guys who had busted Ali up, who had beaten Ali, who had broken his jaw. This dude crushed them in two rounds, and Ali was going to fight him. And it was the same situation he had 10 years previous against Sonny Liston. But that Ali magic, and that he is such a special athlete and had such an unyielding belief in himself and was able to come up with things that people hadn't seen. And it was the rope-a-dope against George Foreman. Defeating George Foreman, I think, was pivotal in his career in that I think he won over his hardest critic. I think post-1974 and certainly post-1975, and that was – and 75 is when he traveled to Manila, Philippines, for his rubber match against Joe Frazier where, you know, he was the defending champion, and it was the, you know – probably the most grueling heavyweight championship of all time, still to this day, really. Nothing compares to it. I mean, they fought. These are heavyweights who were both past their prime, who fought at a rate that would waste a welterweight or a lightweight. They fought at that type of pace, and they did it for 12-plus rounds. They went into the 14th round before the late, great Eddie Futch, trainer of Joe Frazier, kept his man on the stool. And for good reason. But I think after those two fights, after those two triumphs, after the Foreman victory and the rubber match with Frazier, you know, the Rumble in the Jungle and the Thrill in the Manila, stuff that's the folklore of boxing now, he had acceptance, general public acceptance, and he was a huge celebrity worldwide, not just in America. And that's the Ali that I came to know, was this guy who, you know, had this shtick with Howard Cosell. And I was drawn to it because I wasn't a sports fan. I wasn't into sports. I wasn't into basketball or baseball or football. Not that much anyways. I didn't follow any one sports figure. But when, you know, I got my first taste of Ali watching him on TV, I was absolutely hooked. And the first Ali fight I remember watching live and being conscious of during the build-up to the fight was his 1977 fight with Ernie Shavers, who was the hardest puncher in all of boxing. He was the hardest heavyweight puncher in boxing at the time. It knocked out so many good fighters. And he's, to this day, he is recognized, even though he never won a title. he's recognized as arguably the hardest puncher in the heavyweight division in the history of the sport. Definitely one of the hardest punchers ever. You know, Ali beat him. He survived. You know, he beat him over 15 rounds. Actually had Shaver's hurt and going in the 15th round. I don't even remember that. I remember watching it with my dad. I think I fell asleep. I was sitting in his lap. I think I fell asleep. I was 7 years old at the time. But it was important to me that Ali won. And when my dad told me the next day, yeah, Ali, you were right, because my dad was thinking maybe Shavers would get him. It filled me with such pride and, you know, made me shadow box, you know, throw punches, made me want to learn how to box, made me want to know more about boxing in general. And I would come to learn more about boxing, mainly through following the career of Sugar Ray Leonard, who, of course, emerged into a star in his own right after the 76 Olympics. But Ali, to me, was just so much more than a boxer or a boxing champion or a sportsman or an athlete, you know. He was always bigger than sports. He was always larger than life. I mean, he was like a superhero. And I had that comic book that DC Comics put out with Superman versus Ali. You know, I had that. He was big. It was like a oversized collector's edition, and I had that. And I remember reading it thinking, you know, Superman was Superman. He's always supposed to win, right? I remember thinking that, man, they better not have Superman beat Ali, you know. And they didn't, which was awesome. You know, I was like, good. They got it right, you know.
Right.
And, you know, and they were friends afterward. And, like, they had to fight. Like, some alien invasion came and was like, you know, I want your two greatest champions to fight each other. Something kooky like that. And, you know, Superman, you know, fought him without his powers. And, you know, Ali beat his ass, you know. And they were real cool about it afterwards, which is, it was great. I loved it, you know. So that's the only thing I knew. I didn't know. I've got a lot of people now telling me, like, you know, everybody's, you know, talking about what a great man he was and what a great person he was, but he had a mean streak and he was mean to Joe Frazier and this and that, and you know, and yeah, that was there, you know, but that's not the Ali that I came to know. I was born in 1970, you know, I missed all of that. The Ali that I know, he was amazingly playful for a professional fighter, for a prize fighter, for a boxer. I mean, he was, yeah, he had the mean streak, but by that time, you know, the taunting and the nicknames he gave fighters, they loved it. Like, Ernie Shavers loved being called the Icon. It was a badge of honor, you know?
You often thought about, okay, what is he going to come up with, the name? And I think, you know, we're gonna try and wrap this up, because I think you really laid a context to this, and, like, this is where I wanted to go with it, because I think there were a lot of other – there's been a lot said, like you said, there's not much that's been said about Ali, but I love that, you know, for this time with you, we've been able to talk about it through what he's always said. You know, he said, I'm a fighter. You know, he's always defined that. And so we talk about the things that the larger impact he's had, but what I loved about what you've shared with us today is through the lens and through the thread of him as a boxer, which I think on this day, we got to remember that was where it all started. That was what
Absolutely.
It was all about.
That was the public consciousness.
That's what kept him in. So as we kind of wrap it up and you kind of think, I always like this past, present, and the kind of future. As we think about this and what it means, you know, we have some heartbeats going on in the heavyweight division. We actually have a pulse coming out here. You know, when you think about boxers of today, and I'm not saying who can be Ali, but the ability to leverage their platform. See in boxing people who leverage their platform in a way that I would say is more modernized? Who would you kind of put in that larger platform kind of person? Or do you see the potential of that, not at the level of Ali, but, you know, but in that kind of framing?
Yeah, I mean, they'll never be an Ali, because he was just that, you know, once in a lifetime individual who, you know, who came into the public consciousness and obviously into the right sport at the right time in American history. I mean, that's just lightning. That was, you know, Ali really was lightning in the bottle to come at the time that he did, to be a boy from Louisville, Kentucky, growing up in the segregated South, and winning a gold medal in the Rome Olympics. That alone is amazing. What an amazing journey that is. You know what I mean? That's just, you know, as a teenager. But then, you know, from the launch pad of the Olympics into the world of professional boxing, and from the world of professional boxing, a launch pad into international public consciousness. You know, we're never going to see anything like Ali, but I do think that there are some heavyweights out there now who do have personality and have talent, that right mix of personality and talent and potential to where they can garner a lot of attention and really do something with it. And they're belt holders right now. They're undefeated. There's a 2012 Olympic gold medalist from Britain, and you know he's huge over in the UK because he won his gold medal in the London Games, the London Olympic Games. So they're very proud of him. His name is Anthony Joshua, and he's a modern, you know, heavyweight. He's big. He looks like a bodybuilder, but he's very spry. He's actually pretty nimble for a man who's 6'6" and a solid 245 pounds. Very skilled, really intelligent, really mature guy. Says all the right things. Looks like the goods. If you're not aware of Anthony Joshua, I think he fights this month on Showtime. Fights a U.S. Olympian named Dominic. You should check him out. You should go to YouTube and check out some of his fights because he's a very special talent. And there's an American boxer from the South, from Alabama, named Deontay Wilder. And he started boxing late, like a lot of American heavyweights do. One of those guys where, you know, he was a standout in another sport and then found his way to boxing late and found that he had talent in boxing. And with, I think, less than 20 or 25 fights, he made the U.S. Olympic squad for the 2008 Games, and he won a bronze medal. So his nickname is the Bronze Bomber, and he's a boxer puncher. He's very tall and rangy, about 6'7", good long reach. Not as muscular, not as thick as Anthony Joshua, but he gets a lot of power, kind of like that explosive thin man thing, like a Thomas Hearns.
Mm-hmm.
Gets, you know, tall and lean, but gets amazing power on his shots. He's rough around the edges. He's not as polished as Anthony Joshua, but he's a lot of fun to watch. And he's bombastic. He's got that persona that Ali had. You know, Ali was inspired by his favorite wrestlers at the time. He often talks about listening to Gorgeous George, you know, a popular wrestler in the 50s, and wanting to emulate his showmanship, his stage persona. And I often look at Deontay Wilder kind of like a pro wrestler of boxing because he's loud and proud like that. And his fights are very exciting. So these guys, like I say, they're in their athletic primes right now. They're unbeaten. They have versions of the heavyweight title. They're not really recognized as the heavyweight champion. We're in an era of, you know, fractured world titles, and it takes a very special individual to unify all the titles to become the undisputed champion. We don't see that a lot. I would love it if these guys seek out and try to do that. If either one of these guys is able to do that, they can be huge. They can be the most popular athlete on the planet. They have that kind of potential, not just the most popular boxer, but the most popular sportsman.
Well, Doug, I would tell you right now, this reminds me that we need to have you back on the air more with us. We have too long of a gap here. I'm definitely going to get you back on because it's been such a pleasure to talk about this and to, you know, kind of tie a bow to this on a day where, like I said, the world is focused on Louisville, Kentucky, and remembering someone that kind of, I think, had an impact on so many of us in pursuing our own kind of professional dreams or life dreams. That, you know, there are no boundaries. There are no boundaries.
Yeah, he was the ultimate inspiration. Yeah,
that's right.
Yep.
And
likewise.
So, hey, thank you for being with us, and I look forward to having you back on soon because there's a lot to talk about, and we really love having you. So, This is Doug Fisher with us, editor of ringtv.com. Check it out. Check him out. He's incredible. We want to definitely support his efforts. Thank you, Doug.
All right. Anytime.
Lot, talk radio.
This thing right here.
Yeah.
It's for my people in the streets.
Yes, today. You know, as we start this show, this one mic.
We There is a pause throughout the stadium as the man sounds like he just coughs up a lung. They're looking around the Jumbotron shows and fans the cheerleaders, and as it goes down each cheerleader's face, each one breaks up into laughter, which at this particular time destroys half the stadium. The other half is still trying to figure out what the hell just happened. Does this guy need CPR or something? And then at that particular time, I lost it. Devon Drup.
Yes. Today, this one mic.
Phoenix is another place. They got a great training staff. I mean, they were able to breathe life back into Shaq. And you can do that. You know, people talk a lot about their training staff.
Yes, today, you know, as we start this show, this one mic,